when you're dealing with families that are living paycheck to paycheck, there's no knowing what tomorrow is going to look like. So that creates a very stressful situation in the parents' lives. And a lot of times when a parent is experiencing anxiety or stress, children pick that up. It's a physiological thing they pick up from their parents. And then we can talk about, you know, racial issues, cultural issues. We get tense when we talk about it. Maybe we need to talk about it so we don't get so tense about it.
We at the Collective Perspective podcast have set out on a mission to understand some of the most impactful and controversial trends and topics in our lives today. Hi, I'm Jeff.
I'm Travis.
I'm DJ.
Can we find common ground in the middle in a peaceful manner?
Not for political gain,
but for real community benefit.
We believe so. As veterans and concerned citizens, we are bringing together diverse views and fact-based research to navigate this tough terrain in search of a viable path forward.
Only time will tell, but if we listen with open minds and try to understand each other, we just may find a solution, or two, collectively.
That is why we care about what you have to say. If something piques your interest or ruffles your feathers or tickles your fancy or whatever else you'd like, leave us an audio message at podinbox.com/collective-perspective-podcast, all one word, or directly on our show page at mtsjax.fm/collective-perspective-podcast. You'll have to log in, but that won't cost much more than your time.
We'll be discussing your messages on the show, whether you give us a high five or say, hey, you better do some fact-checking, fool. As long as it's positive and it's your perspective, we'll possibly give you some airtime. But remember, it needs to be family-friendly and not defamatory in nature.
Hey, everybody. This is Collective Perspective Podcast, and we're here in sunny Jacksonville, Florida, talking with you
collectively
from the Main Street Suite at Mixed Theory Studios.
Collectively.
Hey, everybody. This is Jeff with the Collective Perspective, and I have my buddies Travis and DJ here. Say what's up, guys.
What's up, guys?
What's up?
And have a very special guest, Anne Marie Schrader.
Hi there.
Anne Marie, what is your specialty?
So I have been an infantile developmental specialist. I worked with the Early Steps program in Northeast Florida through a company called New Heights. I retired back when COVID started because of several issues that came up with seeing families in a home. And right now I do consulting from my home, the safety of my home.
Nice. So you do a lot of Zoom stuff.
Primarily Zoom.
Last week, I mentioned that most statistics are taken, at least by the CDC or Mayo Clinic, rather, where they started talking about mental disorders found in kids from 6 and up, but not 0 through 6. I know a lot of that is to do with parenting and early development. What are some childhood development basics that parents really need to pay attention to have a successful, happy child?
So one of the things a lot of us think when we have children, we think we know how to raise children. The reality is human beings are not like other mammalians. We need a little more guidance and instruction on how to raise children. So first thing is we should never assume we know how best to raise our kids. The second thing is, quite oftentimes, we are basing the way we raise our children on our own personal experiences. And some of those experiences are sometimes good and sometimes they're not so good. So what we take and transfer what we've acquired during our own childhood and sometimes carry it over into raising our own children. And sometimes if we're not aware of what we're saying, doing, thinking, it could take a cycle of abuse, neglect, or not so great parenting style and just continue it with not only our children, but maybe even our own grandchildren.
According to the CDC, 1 in 6 of U.S. children aged 2 and 8 years old, 17.4% has diagnosed mental behavior.
So part of the problem with having a more mental health issues in young children has to do with the way we live. If you go back a few years, we used to have one person in the household worked and one person stayed home and kept focus on the children. What we're seeing a lot more of is a lot less focus on child rearing and a lot more focus on trying to pay the bills and sometimes a lack of parenting style where a parent is engaging with the child. So that factors partially into what's going on with whether or not we're recognizing there are mental health issues with our children, or if we are actually promoting the type of behaviors and healthy thought processes we want in our children.
Another stat I came up with from WebMD.com says nearly 5 million children in the U.S. have some type of serious mental disease, one that significantly interferes with daily life. In any given way, 20% of American children would be diagnosed with a mental disease. How much of that is to push drug sales?
So I think with our society, we think more along the lines of it's easier to take a pill and solve the problem. But the reality of that is actually something else. When we have children who either have a genetic condition that runs in the family, I can say from a personal perspective that happens, there is no amount of pill that's going to correct the problem. Whereas if you have children that are brought up in an environment that is traumatizing, neglectful, harmful, then that type of trauma is not necessarily something you could correct either with a pill. And I think we're running too much to pills and not spending enough time on building social communications and relationships.
Well, that's kind of like the drive-through society. We want our things and we want it now, and here's a pill to correct it or mask it or cover it up.
Another problem is our science is getting better. We're recognizing autism. We're recognizing some of these little idiosyncrasies in our genetic makeup. It's not necessarily a terrible or bad thing. It's about this is what makes us human. You know, if you spoke to someone who had Asperger's, the way they communicate, socialize, and interact with you is completely different than the next person. That does not make them a mentally sick person. Whereas someone with depression or anxiety or panic attacks, you know, they have to learn how to live within their environment, and people have to learn how to accept them.
What's the difference between gentle parenting and permissive parenting?
Okay, so gentle parenting, it's kind of a gray area. I did some research at the University of Florida, and they identified three major parenting styles. And permissive was the one that would kind of fit along a gentle parenting style. It's similar in the way that you're letting the child run the house. And I don't know if you identify gentle parenting in that regard, because gentle parenting could mean using appropriate language with the child without yelling or screaming at them, which would be traumatizing. So parenting that is gentle might not be permissive.
Where does spanking your child fit into those two?
It doesn't kind of fall under any of the parenting styles, because there's three major parenting styles, and I just read that there is another one out there. And spanking a child it's not a parenting style. It's corporal punishment, if you will. And it's not under any of the parenting styles. But if you had to put it in one, it would be like an authoritarian type.
My parents hit me, you know, gave me a lot of good whoopings. I don't hold it against them, but I think it's because it's a generational thing.
I've been whipped.
Where do you think, like, that came from, you know, like chastising a child, you know, physically disciplining them?
So a lot of our parenting styles evolve from what we experienced in our own childhood, you know, either ourselves or our partner. And I can say I personally have experienced that. I remember having a boyfriend at one point in time, and his daughter was, you know, I didn't know how to deal with his daughter. He had his own thought and how to deal with it. And, you know, I had to either go with the flow or leave the relationship.
Now, is there a way to break that generational cycle of trauma?
So one of the best ways to go about breaking that vicious cycle is going back to what I was saying a little earlier. Never assume you know how to raise a child, and to seek out resources to understand what child rearing practices should look like in our culture. And if we have in our own lives experienced some form of neglect, abuse from a parent, it's always good to kind of talk about that with someone, or at least get that out of your system, because it usually carries over into our relationship, whether it's with a significant other or with our children. So it's important to be aware of that and to try to get over our own trauma.
So it has long-term effects, obviously.
Yes, a child, when traumatized, even once, it becomes embedded in their system.
I was reading somewhere in my research that every child that does go through that from the developmental ages of 1 through 5, it is embedded into their personality for the rest of their lives. Do you think that's why there's so many serial killers on Netflix that have that trait?
You know, I don't have time for Netflix. But
I don't either every day. But.
I used to watch it. But just to talk about from a child development standpoint, one reason abuse and neglect happens is that parents don't understand what their child's behavior should look like. And that's another assumption that too many people make, is they think this is what should be expected from a child. And when that child actually has a developmental challenge or has a potential for a disability, they don't recognize it until it's too late. And that's where the trauma, the neglect, and the abuse can evolve.
Do you think neglect of emotional development is overlooked?
Yes, it definitely is overlooked. As a society, we're spending so much time on the go, 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 that we don't take a moment to sit back and observe what's going on in front of us. And parents tend to non-parent a lot. They hand their child off to someone else. They hand it off to the school to deal with the development. I see someone on a device all the time, and that tends to wire a child's brain differently, and it works up into adulthood too.
That does lead me to my next question pertaining to that. A lot of the children being so connected to their electronic devices, that kind of draws a wedge and division between the family, because, you know, it's the adults or the parents could be adulting, you know, paying the bills, making sure everything is good. And then the child is off in their own world, and it could be hours that they're in their electronic device, and attention and affection isn't really there. So do you think that plays a factor?
So devices are not babysitters, but that's a lot of time. That's what the parents are using them for. And they are missing a tremendous opportunity to interact and learn what their child's behaviors are like.
Just some more stats I found on PubMed.gov. It seems like the Australians really like to put some stuff out there.
Mm. Shout out to the Australians.
What?
In India.
In India.
And our fans in India, yes. Anne-Marie, we have fans in India, believe it or not.
That wouldn't surprise me.
I was surprised, but I'm very flattered.
And grateful. Nice.
And grateful. Okay, so worldwide, 15 to 23% of children live with parents with mental illnesses. These children have up to 50% chance of developing a mental illness themselves. Where does nature and nurture debate come into child development? Is it a debate?
It is, and it isn't. Nature and nurture, if you look at it and say, oh, nature takes over in how a child's being reared. I don't think humans have the same instincts as a mammalian creature would, like a dog or a cat. They seem to have built-in instincts, whereas I think as humans, we're considered higher level thinking, and we need a lot more guidance in raising our children. If you look at several animals, yes, and if you look at how they raise their young, they're very different, whereas humans, we have to raise our children for a lot longer.
When I hear nature versus nurture, that's the person's innate inner self coming out, and nurture is the environment in which they're in, and the parents not just raising them, but guiding them towards what is perceived as a better path.
So from that perspective, I would say that the nature is nature of the beast. You've heard the term nature of the beast. This is how I am. This is what I bring with me as a parent from how I was raised. Whereas nurture seems to be a more learned skill that you have to learn if your way of parenting or nurturing your child is appropriate for the child's personality.
What I read was a little bit different perspective in that if you were born in a family that has genetic traits of mental disorder of some sort, like, say, schizophrenia is a popular one that is passed on, that is nature. Nature has created that. And to nurture them, you can nurture them away from that mental disorder if you nurture them correctly.
And maybe you can comment on this too. There are a lot of medical conditions, including mental health disorders, that, you know, they're genetic. They're built, they're coded into your system. But
there's no way to beat them?
There is. The thing is, if you're exposed to an environment that facilitates that disorder to come out, then you're more likely to get it. Whereas if you're in a safe and secure environment, you're less likely to develop that mental disorder. But I think there are some that they do come out.
I can't speak factually on that, but I've seen in my line of work, I've seen a lot of that where you're absolutely right. When people are using the example of schizophrenia, they tend to, there's a trigger that sets them off, and I don't know what it is. They probably don't know what it is, but something sets off a manic phase and they just start doing one thing, and then they get off of their medicines that they were on because the medicines make them feel funny. And then they start self-medicating, and then they start going down that rabbit hole of drug addiction with alcohol, marijuana, cocaine, whatever drug it is that they want to feed. That mania is what they're going to go towards, and it just makes the situation worse and harder to treat.
Yeah, it's definitely a tough thing for everybody when someone in your family has a mental disorder or, you know, just going through mental issues like anxiety problems. I mean, how many households throughout the U.S. have anxiety, and then the kids get anxiety because their parents have anxiety because that's a learned thing, you know?
So with mental health issues like that, and I live in an environment like that, you have to consider not only the mental health of the person that has anxiety, but you also need to consider the mental health of the person that's involved with it, because it's something that can cycle around the house, almost like a virus. When you're around someone or some persons that are suffering constant mental health problems, you tend to experience them too.
It's difficult because I can personally say, without, you know, jeopardizing my relationship with my wife, that she has anxiety issues. And, you know, I ask her all the time, I know the answer, but I said, what's wrong? She said, I don't know. It's always, I don't know the answer. Is that common in anxiety?
It's common in anxiety, and anxiety usually comes with some level of depression. I've actually experienced, not me personally, but I have a family member that has panic attacks. You know, I think I know what the trigger is, but it's scary for a caregiver to see that happen. I wanted to mention something else about some mental health disorders that are tied into development. When we live in an environment where we're exposed to things like polluted water, that impacts the mental and physiological health of children and adults. And I've seen a lot of that here in Jacksonville.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I know lead leads to plumism, which is a mental decline. It affects the neurons and the brain matter from connecting properly.
You know, last episode we talked about what are the five risk factors for a mental disorder. One of them, as we mentioned, was genetic disposition, alcohol, drug use, family conflict and family disorganization, stressful life events such as a PTSD type thing. And the other two, surprisingly, I don't quite understand. So is discrimination and racial injustice and homelessness and unemployment. I don't see how those two correlate as risk factors. And this is according to another Australian study, WCH.gov, health and well-being of mental health issues.
I've seen that quite a bit. Yeah. I worked for Head Start for a while. And when you're dealing with families that are living paycheck to paycheck, there's no knowing what tomorrow is going to look like. So that creates a very stressful situation in the parents' lives. And a lot of times when a parent is experiencing anxiety or stress, children pick that up. It's a physiological thing they pick up from their parents. And then we can talk about, you know, racial issues, cultural issues. We get tense when we talk about it. Maybe we need to talk about it so we don't get so tense about it.
So that intensity and upset, you know, getting upset, getting your blood pressure up causes mental disorders?
It can contribute to it, I think.
Do you think kids are more influenced by their same-sex parent?
So a few years back, I worked at a mother's center up in New York, and we would run family meetings. And we would talk about how a parent's relationship is with their child. A female parent has a different relationship with her daughter than she would with her son. Usually the nurturing would be more towards the opposite sex parent-child relationship. So a mother and a son might get along better than the mother and the daughter, and vice versa.
Yeah, it's common.
Yes, and I have never seen that talked about here in Florida. When I lived in New York, we had a mother center. It was very inexpensive to come to our meetings, and we would have very specific topics where we would talk about single-parent family, two kids, one boy, one girl, because the relationship is different in your family structure.
Yeah, it does seem like that, you know, like during the years of the parents raising the child, like the son and father might, you know, might maybe confrontational a little bit. It may be
butt heads.
Yeah, might butt heads, just like the mother and daughter may butt heads a lot. But then later on, when they're, you know, when the child is grown or becoming a young adult, it kind of gets better, or their relationship improves, I would say.
It's part of the child-adult development process. If you were in a family where there were three children and you were the middle child, and that's my situation, that middle child feels completely different about their place in their families as compared to the oldest child, who tends to dominate, and the youngest child, who tends to be the little baby. So family, how your family set up makes a difference in terms of how each person perceives their roles and develops.
One of the things you mentioned earlier was parents don't always know the best way to be parents. And I think that really ties into intellectual humility. Do you know the definition of intellectual humility?
I would say it's not assuming you know anything. Don't assume you know the answer. Go look it up. Do your research. Do your homework. That's my idea of it.
Yeah, it's being able to accept that maybe your perspective isn't 100% correct, and that you can accept the fact that you're wrong.
When presented with compelling information, you can say, yeah, hey, I was wrong. I've changed my mind. Being able to admit that you were wrong about a position.
Well, what I'm leading to is, okay, so we've talked about people having disorders and having these problems, but how do they get help? And I know that's kind of a big spectrum, but if we're talking about the development of children, which I kind of wanted this podcast to focus on more, is because it's so important to the rest of their lives. I think just some parents need to hear this and realize that maybe their parenting skills need some intellectual humility in their lives. And I know we're not all perfect. I know I'm not the perfect parent, and I learn and try to be a better father every day. And a lot of it is just slowing down and listening.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I remember I worked with the couple of family members. And so part of it would extend out to the family member, the parents feeling comfortable to having a conversation. And that conversation might be with another family member they trust, or it could be with a pediatrician in terms of their own child's development, or even a psychologist if they felt that their child had something going on. But first, to acknowledge when you raise a child, when you go to have a baby, that's your opportunity to start doing your homework. If you bought a car and you like to do work on the car, what would you do? You'd go buy a user manual for the car.
No, I would take the car apart and then try to figure out how to put it back together with a YouTube video. No, I'm just kidding.
Then you'd make the mistake.
I'm just joking.
I mean, it's a learning experience. It's a harder learning experience. I think our educational system needs to bring up the fact that we're humans and we're going to have children at some point in time, or maybe we won't, and that we need to understand a little bit more about child development before we jump into the next.
Well, they took home ec out of schools, didn't they?
They did take it out of a lot of schools. They didn't think it was important.
They took driver's ed and auto mechanics out, too.
Which shop?
Did Gone.
Yeah.
Which is sad, because all of those are things that people could actually get jobs doing and making money.
Yep.
One thing I would like to, a point that's easier to address raising children and knowing how they develop. Doctors in general are not educated on early childhood development. They are not really trained in psychological development I mean, and we talked a little bit early, the two of us, about nutrition. They're not trained in nutrition either. So when you're having a child and you're going out and you're finding your pediatrician, don't automatically assume they're going to know early childhood development. In recent years, with the apparently increase in autism, a lot more of the practices are using assessments from birth on up to help you know where your child's going.
What are some early warning signs that your child might have some developmental issues that need to be addressed?
So for very young children, and I worked mostly with birth to three, we were able to recognize some potential signs of autism in very young children. Not making eye contact, not making typical sounds, cooing, crying. If a child doesn't cry, that's actually a bad sign and not a good sign. They should cry some of the time, but also if they cry too much of the time. So there's a couple of resources you could go to see if your child's doing that. The CDC has a place you can go to where you can look up early childhood development for a child by age, and it's usually 3-month intervals. You can look at social emotional development through a questionnaire called Ages and Stages, and that you can find either through your local pediatrician or you can go to Easter Seals. And if you really do think your child has a developmental problem, pediatrician's your first course. If you still feel strongly about that, then you could approach the local Early Steps program. They work mostly with birth to three. And if the child's older than three, then you could seek out having an evaluation through the Center for Autism and Related Disabilities.
That's where actually Anna Marie I met, is an Early Steps program for my son. He had a speech delay, and you definitely made a difference in our lives and how to raise him.
Thank you.
And I'm internally grateful. So let's talk about kids that are in an abusive family and need to get out of that situation. You had mentioned to me earlier that a lot of DCF makes it worse.
Well, they do a lot of good. I think the most traumatic part that they do, and it's not because they mean to do it, is when you pull a child out of a living situation, it's traumatizing. And the amount of time they spend investigating, and it just draws out the process of, I would say it's like you're losing your parent or parents losing their child. And if you ever read Kubler-Ross, The Steps of Dying, when you lose something or lose someone, you go through a lot of similar processes where you have to acknowledge that it's happening. You have to learn how to accept it. And there is a phase where you grieve and maybe you let go. And I'm not an expert on that, but there's a lot of similarities of healing.
Yeah, yes. Or grieving.
And
yes.
Young children go through it differently. And, you know, when you're suddenly just pulled out of a situation, even though the environment is abusive, that will traumatize a child in a way.
But don't you have to look at the long-term effect of how that's going to affect the kid? Like, look, the kid could die, or they're better off being with this family and making that adjustment than they are in the situation they're in. Where do they draw the line?
So it's important that when a child is taken out of the situation, that the new situation that they're placed in, that it's usually a foster environment and sometimes a very temporarily placed situation, that whoever's stepping in to be that guardian is very nurturing, very caring, and just very calm about the whole situation and not engaging in what just happened. They're taking that child and moving them forward and giving them, you know, what they need and more of it because they've been through that.
Being that children and parents were stuck at home during the pandemic, do you think it kind of exacerbated the situations a lot? Or, you know, like the cheating husband couldn't come up with an excuse why he was leaving, you know, because where else are you going to go? You can't go anywhere.
I think anyone that had to stay at home with their kids had no idea what their kids were like.
In a lot of ways, it was good. I felt like it really brought some, you know, understanding and not having to live the fast-paced life. And I don't have time today to go play with you. I'm sorry.
I think they seen another side of their kid.
Yes, that's probably true.
They probably saw another side of themselves.
Parents that haven't been parenting their children are now placed in a situation where they have to parent the child. They have to do the discipline of the child, which has been pushed off onto the school or daycare. and now they suddenly have to deal with it, and then they're supposed to be earning their pay at the same time. So it creates a situation. You're in home, contained, and they tell you can't get outside. You know, it's rough.
I know that's what they said, but I didn't do that.
Well, but I didn't either.
In my line of work, I couldn't afford to.
Well, my business changed dramatically when COVID-19 hit. You know, a lot of anxiety started. People were afraid to have you coming into their homes. At one point in time, we were told that we could not go into the homes. So we had to actually start doing video HIPAA-compliant meetings with the families, which transitioned the way I did my business. It used to be teach a child how to, then it went to coach the parent. And now, in a way, it was really good because now I'm from a distance coaching the parent on what to do, and the parent's got to do it. I'm not the one doing it with the child. That parent had to get their hands into the situation.
Right. When you were with us, you gave physical instruction because you were there.
Yes, and there's a big difference. And being able to step back and be in the backdrop and have the parents do the work was a big change within the Early Steps program. And parents were forced more into having to do it. And it was an eye-opening experience for them. So I think a couple of good things came out of the COVID situation. But I had so many cancellations.
And how many of them had their cameras off?
Well, for the Early Steps families, they were required to have cameras
on. Or wore masks while they're at home with their kids. I think it was ridiculous.
I did not see masks in the home. And I want to tell you, one of the developmental milestones, which is communication and then speech or language. Okay, I have a mask on. Can you hear me? Can you see my face? Young kids need to see you speak in order to learn.
To make the mouth formations, to form the letters, the sounds that the words make.
And if you take it into senior citizens, because during the height of COVID, I worked with 65 and over. I had to teach classes with an N95 mask on my face. They could not hear me. So it was a challenging time.
Well, I think that it did help the medical world, the COVID, in that we had the technology. We've had technology to do remote meetings like this for a long time. It just forced the hand to make it more compliant for medical purposes, for medical use at this time. It made it the doctor, and in some cases, more accessible to the patient. Not just the doctor, but the practice, whoever's there following, whether it's family practice, primary care, mental health, or pediatrics. They all have a better readily available avenue, especially if they live far away in rural settings and whatnot.
One of the downsides is that when you're dealing with a HIPAA-compliant system, there's a lot more data transfer going on. So if you live in a house like I do and there's like 8 computers going on at the same time and everyone's on the internet, if someone's bound to get bounced off, and that's why that happened quite a bit.
I know in my nursing practice, we generally will take a theory from a couple of different theorists and make a plan of care, a nursing plan of care for the patients. I don't necessarily see that in the mental health, but I've not been involved in mental health that much.
So mental health, when you're talking about when someone's mentally not well, you have to think about what their environment is like too. And I'm going to go back to early childhood. There are 5 domains of development. And if you do not get enough exposure in any of those domains, that's going to affect your mental health ultimately. For example, being physically active. We learn through physical contact with our environment. If we don't, we tend to lose some of the other areas of development. So I'll give an example. I had a little boy who was 17 months old. He was in the Early Steps program, and I came to see him at daycare once. Well, I saw him several times. And I walked into the daycare, said, okay, where is he? And they direct me into the infant room. He's 17 months old. So I walk into the room, and he's in a crib, face down, and they had 9-month-old children on the floor. A young child like him, 17 months old, put in with a group of children who are
half his age.
Right. And he's not being encouraged and promoted to develop as a 17-month-old, both from a physical side, from a language side, from a social side, or a motor, too, because you know, children do engage in oral motor fixations that drive some of us parents crazy, but it has to be known that's typical and it's normal. But to see a 17-month-old being put into a 9-month-old classroom limits that child's development even further because they were not aware that child had a disability.
Wow. Or
didn't think that putting a child into a younger classroom was actually going to hurt him even more than trying to get him in with his peers.
There's definitely more to a daycare than the meets the eye, or it should.
There should be. I can tell you in that situation, I saw what was going on, and I was, I guess, a little flabbergasted. I said something to the director when I left. Nothing major, but then when I spoke to the parent, I think she was upset at me initially. And then I think she may have realized what was going on because she paid attention to the situation. They were keeping him in the infant room because he couldn't walk.
Well, doesn't that kind of go back to intellectual humility? Like, yeah. I know we didn't want to accept the fact that my son might have a problem. And it took research and other people's opinions and perspectives and analysis, your expertise, to say, yeah, he actually does have a speech delay and you need to treat it. And I think that a lot of people overlook that. Like, no, there's nothing wrong with them.
I lived with that situation, too. That's how I got into early intervention. My oldest son, who's now 21, you know, about 13, 15 months, I was volunteering at a mother's center, and a social worker came in and said, who's the mother of that beautiful little blonde boy? And I was like, me? And she's like, can I talk to you for a minute? I didn't think anything was wrong at the time. I got pulled into a corner for a private conversation. It wasn't like, I gotta talk to you, you're abusing your child. And she said it to me. She's like, there's a problem here. Your son's not walking, he's not talking. And my attitude at the time was, well, he's going to live to be 80, so he'll develop the way he's supposed to develop. And I don't want to say how wrong I was about it, but I had to get educated on child development. And I have 3 master's degrees. I had 2 by that time. And, you know, I had to eat a little humble pie to realize I needed to take some action. My pediatrician hadn't done anything. Everything's fine. Everything's normal. Don't worry about it. I'll come around. Even my own husband was not really on board with it to start. And that's when I went back and I got a degree in early childhood special education. And even years later, my family has actually some mental health condition. So I'm always advocating for my son because I knew and then went to get the education so I would be able to come here today and talk to you.
You've been listening to the Collective Perspective Podcast, a mature show with the intention of making a difference in society. I did want to make some corrections from last week. I was talking about someone that got in a car accident, Rosie O'Donnell, and it's actually Roseanne Barr that was that person. So I apologize for giving you misinformation, but here I am telling you that I was wrong. We also felt here on the podcast that it was really important because, you know, we were looking at all this data and all this information last week in the Mayo Clinic this, and I was like, Travis, what about 0 through 5? You know, like, there has to be some type of way to get it early, and if you address the issue early, then you have a better chance of the long-term effect being what you want.
A better outcome.
A better outcome.
Yes. So if you are the parent of a child between birth and 3 years of age, you can bring up the issue with your pediatrician. You can go online and look for one of the developmental questionnaires on the Center for Disease website. They're in multiple languages on their website. And if your doctor is saying, no, it's okay, if you really have that gut feeling that you need to take this a step further, call your local Early Steps program. You can schedule a screening over the phone. If they feel it's justified and warranted, they will come and do an evaluation on your child, or you can go to their office. And it's important. With children under the age of 12 that have a high risk for autism, the more you can do while they're young is the more likely you're going to correct the brain development so they are on par with their language, communication, and social skills.
And, you know, they're going to have peers one day that are going to make fun of them or not, you know, and being able to cope with that, or at least having a head start
that could lead to mental health illness, and not to mention so many other things like violence in the schools.
Absolutely.
Our kids are so important to us. Well, thank you again.
Thank you for having
me. Really appreciate
thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Peace. You've been listening to the Collective Perspective Podcast, a mature show with the intention of making a difference in society.
So take a ride with us. Join us at the Collective Perspective Podcast, where your personal truths get a little power wash.
Like what you heard? Subscribe to the Collective Perspective Podcast whenever you listen to your podcasts.
You can also show support for our mission by going to buymeacoffee.com/collectivepod and donating whatever you feel inspired to. We appreciate any help keeping the lights on to bring you thoughtful and researched content as part of this show.
Visit the Collective Perspective Podcast show page on mtsjax.fm, Jacksonville's new music and multimedia network sponsored by Mixed Theory Studios. You can find the transcripts of this episode along with the show notes, material references, links you heard about, and more.
Hey, I want to give a special shout out and a thanks to The Real Jay Dash, a Jacksonville hero, producer, and artist, for sharing his original music with this show, and to the Mixed Theory Studios for recording and production services. We couldn't have done it without either of them. Thank you so much.